Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Medical Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School and is a public service. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's tribes today when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law, law school professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. He said, quote, it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. It's worse than that, he said. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. A student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the Lost Ten Tribes of the House of Israel, a book written by Stephen Collins. Israel's tribes today. Where are they located? Well, we discovered that Ephraim is in Great Britain, Manasseh is in the United States, Reuben's in France, Zebulun in Holland, Asher in South Africa, Issachar in Finland, Naphtali in Sweden, Benjamin in Norway, and now we're up to Dan, number nine, if you've been writing these down, keeping track of them. Number nine is Dan. Where are the Danites? Well, they're in Denmark, and it's called Danmark over there. We call it Denmark in the United States, but it's Danmark in, well, of all places, Denmark. Dan was the son of Jacob, a son of Jacob, and Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid. And when the Israelites entered Canaan, Dan was given an inheritance south of Ephraim's territory. Later, they divided into two groups after some Danites conquered a second homeland in the northern part of Canaan. We read that in Joshua 19, verse 46, which indicates that the initial Danite territory included the port of Joppa. When the Danites conquered a second homeland in the north, Joshua 19:47 records that the Danites conquered the city of Leshem, and then they renamed it Dan. Now, after the name of Dan, their ancestor, in conquering a second homeland, the Danites apparently acted without the permission or cooperation of any other Israelite tribe, indicating a tendency of the Danites to act unilaterally from all of the other tribes of Israel. They also displayed a willingness to subdivide their tribe into more than one homeland. The Danite trait of naming geographical locations after the name of their forefather Dan is important when we follow the Israelites' migrations. The Danites retained this trait throughout history, leaving a trail of Danite names along their migratory paths. The Danites along the coast of ancient Israel divided again, as we see in Judges 5 verse 17, written about 1200 BC. And it states that the Danites were by then living in ships, that the Danites already practiced a seafaring way of life, and at that time is confirmed by secular historical sources recording that a seafaring tribe bearing the name of Dan was then active in the eastern Mediterranean Ocean. The Encyclopedia Britannica records that these sea raiders were active in the Levant between 1230 and 1190 BC, and that the Egyptian sources named them the Danua, and they called them the Zakari, while Greek tradition refers to them as the Danans. The word Levant refers to the eastern Mediterranean, which includes the seacoast of Israel, the main base of the tribe of Dan. And it is significant that the name of another group accompanying the Danite Sea Raiders included the root word T-Z-A-K, Zak, because it's a Hebrew form of the name Isaac. Two modern Israeli leaders with this Hebrew name were Yitzhak Shamir and Yitzhak Rabin. If one represents the T-Z sound with an S, both symbols are related sibilant consonants. The name of this ancient tribe becomes the Zakari, indicating that they were also Israelites. This is an important point, as it indicates that Israelites were known as the Saka, S-A-K-A, in ancient Israel centuries before their descendants, the Saka, S-A-K-A, or S-A-C-A-E, Sake, were known by that name in Asia. These sea raiders were known as the sea peoples in ancient history, who had some roots in Anatolia, that's modern Turkey today. The region of modern Turkey associated with ancient Troy used to be called Dardania, and one of the narrow straits between the Aegean and the Black Seas is still called the Dardanelles. Given the above, the seafaring portions of the tribe of Dan not only contributed many of its people to the ancient sea peoples, but also colonized regions of Anatolia near Troy. And for a fuller history of the Danite role of the sea peoples, the reader is referred to the first book in this series. The presence of the name Dan in ancient Anatolia and the region of Troy also argues that Danites were involved in establishing Israelite colonies in that area. Moses prophesied in Deuteronomy 33, verse 22, that the tribe of Dan would leap from Bashan, part of ancient Israel, and historical evidence indicates that the Danites did indeed leap from ancient Canaan to settle new colonies of their own. The Tuatha De Dananann arrived in Ireland around 721 B.C., at the same time when many Israelites fled from Assyrian captivity. Since both biblical and secular accounts indicate the tribe of Dan was a seafaring tribe, it is not surprising that the Danites on the seacoast chose a maritime escape route from ancient Israel to avoid Assyrian captivity. These Danann were prominent early settlers of Ireland. So the tribe of Dan was present in large numbers there. Many Irish people today could therefore trace their ancestry to the tribe of Dan. However, the Danites in the northern part of Israel lacked a maritime escape route. These Danites apparently migrated northward into the Black Sea region, along with many other Israelite tribes, becoming one of the Scythian or Saki tribes. Rivers emptying into the Black Sea used to be named the Ister, the Tiris, the Borysthenes, and the Tanais. After the Scythians arrived, the Black Sea rivers were renamed the Danube, and the Dniester, and the Dnieper, and the Don. And Collier's Encyclopedia states the names of the rivers Danube, Dniester, Dnieper, and the Don are Scythian names, and that the names of all of these rivers were given Scythian names bearing the name of the Israelite tribe name of Dan further confirms that the Scythians were Israelites and that the northern Danites had joined the Israelite migration to the Black Sea region. These Danites would have migrated into Europe with the Scythians in later centuries. Based on their tribal history, we should expect their name to reveal where they went. In Europe, the name of the tribe of Dan followed the Danube River, resurfaced in places such as Danzig, Poland, and Danmark. The Danish name for Denmark is Danmark. The language of Denmark is called Danish, and the people are called the Danes. Now, since the name of the tribe of Dan is still borne by the people of Denmark, also known as Danmark, it is logical to conclude that many Danish people have descended from that portion of the tribe of Dan, which previously lived in northern Palestine and the Scythian region by the Black Sea. Genesis 49, verses 16 and 17 offers this prophecy about Dan in the latter days. It says, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path which biteth the horse's heels, so that his rider shall fall backward. Unquote. Now, when we look at the heraldry of the Danites, they have a shield with a serpent crawling on it. In America, they had the picture of a rattlesnake on the shield with the words that said, "Don't tread on me." The Hebrew word translated judge can also be translated discern. The text also likens Dan to a serpent or a snake, and many readers have likely seen nature documentaries showing that the telltale path of a sidewinder snake in a desert reveals the track of the snake even after the snake is no longer present. A possible meaning of Genesis 49, verses 16 and 17's cryptic passage is that one can discern or judge where the tribes of Israel migrated by following the names of the tribe of Dan throughout history. The Danites left their name wherever they went, revealing their trail throughout history, just like the telltale path of a sidewinder snake in the desert. This analysis reflects the reality of what happened in history. Now, a possible explanation for the second part of the prophecy is as follows. The Danites are pictured as being under the heels of a horse, but they succeed in throwing off the rider by biting the heels of his horse. Now, the Irish were governed by or under the heels of the British, the rider, until the early 1920s. The Irish won their independence in the 20th century by way of a terrorist campaign against the British, nipping at the heels of the rider, and the prophecy of Genesis 49 aptly describes the manner in which the Irish obtained their independence in their country. This same activity continued into modern times as the Irish Republican Army, called the IRA, and it utilized the same terrorist activities against the British in an attempt to overthrow British rule in Northern Ireland as well. And in this sense, the Genesis 49 prophecy captures the nature of the struggle of the Irish against the British in the modern world. It's not open warfare, but rather a nipping at the heels by way of terrorist acts. A preponderance of evidence indicates that the Irish are one portion of the modern Danite tribe. A second portion of Danites migrated to Denmark and Europe by way of the Black Sea route, imprinting the name of Dan on the route of their migrations. Dan is located in two places, both in historical times and in ancient times. So Dan is located in Denmark and Ireland. Gad. The tribe of Gad, rising from defeat to prominence. Gad was a son of Jacob and Zilpah, the handmaid of Leah. Gad's inheritance was east of the Jordan River in Gilead when the Israelites came into Canaan. Therefore, Gad was one of the easternmost tribes of Israel in its ancient inheritance. This tribe was taken into Asian captivity by the Assyrians years before the fall of Samaria. And they were one of the many Saki or Saka tribes of Asia who were eventually pushed westward into Europe. To identify Gad in the modern world, we must rely upon the brief but very revealing prophetic clue of Genesis 49, verse 19, which states, Gad, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. Now, interestingly, the tribe of Gad is the only Israelite tribe which is prophesied to be overcome during the latter days. The Hebrew word for troop also means an invading force. To locate the Gadites, we must look for a European nation which during the latter days was overcome by invading forces but later emerged triumphant from its defeat. So at this point, we're left with few remaining alternatives. Most of the nations of northwestern Europe and Scandinavia have already been identified as various members of the modern tribes of Israel. So the process of elimination leaves us with such nations as Belgium, Switzerland, and Germany. Now, Belgium and Switzerland are amalgam nations composed of several racial or ethnic groups. Belgium is mostly a mixture of ethnic Dutch and French people, the Flemish and Walloons, and is therefore a likely mixture of Zebulonite and Reubenite people. Switzerland is also a mixture of German, French, and Italian-speaking people. The French Swiss are likely Reubenites, but the other Swiss ethnic groups would represent other groups. And also, Switzerland has not been overcome by invading troops or armies in centuries, so it cannot possibly fit the prophecy about the tribe of Gad. So by default, this leaves Germany as the most likely candidate for our indication or our research for the modern Gadites. Germany indeed was overcome by a troop of nations in World War II, and yet Germany emerged to become one of the foremost industrial and economic powers in the world. It has again become one of the dominant nations of modern Europe, and it has truly overcome at the last. The nation of Germany uniquely fulfills Genesis 49's prophecy about the Gadites in the latter days. Another biblical prophecy about Gad is fulfilled in the Germans, and in Deuteronomy chapter 33, although it is not time-specific to the latter days, includes prophecies by Moses about the futures of the tribes of Israel. In verse 20 of that chapter prophesies, Blessed be he that enlarges Gad. Gad couches like a lion. He tears the arm and the crown of the head. This prophecy indicates that Gad would have a large population, or be enlarged, and exhibit a predatory nature, a lion, who tears at other nations. Germany is one of the largest nations of modern Europe, fulfilling the prophecy that they would be enlarged. The warlike characteristics and the prowess of the Germans are well known, and they have twice fulfilled the role of a predatory lion in the modern era, both World War I and World War II, attacking and tearing at neighboring nations. The above, together with the fact that Genesis 49's prophecy requires that the Gadites will be overcome by a troop, but will recover from their defeat to overcome during the latter days. This clearly points to the Germans, and there is additional evidence which points to an Israelite origin for the nation of Germany. One of the tribes in the ancient Parthian Empire was known as the Kermans, or the Germani. When the Parthian Empire collapsed, its component peoples fled out of Asia and became known as the Caucasians, from the Caucasus Mountains in Russia. It's where the word Caucasian comes from today. As they migrated through the Caucasus Mountains toward Europe in large numbers, the name of this ancient Parthian tribe became very prominent among the Parthian and Scythian tribes migrating into Europe as refugees now seeking new homelands. Indeed, the Romans named many different migrating tribes and nations under the overall name of Germans. Therefore, we can see that the name German originated in the ancient Parthian Empire of Saki tribes, and this name has transplanted, or was transplanted, from Parthian Asia into modern Europe. However, this book does not assert that all Germans are Israelites of the tribe of Gad. The modern Germans are a numerous people with several ethnic divisions. There are three German-speaking nations in Europe: Germany, Austria, and most of Switzerland. Other nations in Europe also have German-speaking contingents. Today's German-speaking population of Europe has descended from a variety of Caucasian tribes that migrated into Europe from Asia. Given that there were many tribes called German by the Romans, there is ample room for the modern German-speaking people to include the tribe of Gad, contingents of other Israelite tribes, and some non-Israelites also descending from Shem. Genesis 10, verses 21 through 31, confirms that many nations are descended from Shem, in addition to the Hebrews and the Israelites, who descended from the man named Eber, from which we get the word Heber or Hebrew. One historian of the German people, S. Bering Gul, wrote that the German people migrating into Europe were divided into four major subdivisions: the Alemanni, the Franks, the Saxons, and the Goths. Now, we have already documented the Israelite nature of the Saxons, the Goths, and the Franks. In Roman times, these major tribes all spoke the same language. As the centuries passed, they developed their own languages and dialects. The language of the Anglo-Saxons, who migrated into the British Isles and from there to North America, Australia, New Zealand, and other lands, gradually developed into the modern English language. However, ancient English manuscripts clearly preserve the Germanic origin of the English language. The Dutch and Norwegian languages also developed from the ancient Germanic language. Indicative of the common origin for the Saxon and German people is the fact that the English and German languages are closely related tongues from the same alphabet and many cognate words. The Franks gave their name to the nation of France, but because they were long dominated by the Roman and Holy Roman Empires, their modern language, French, developed not from the Germanic language, but from the Romance languages of Southern Europe. Clearly, many modern nations of Europe have developed from the many diverse tribes and clans of Parthian and Scythian refugees who migrated into Europe, but who were first known collectively as Germans by the Romans. Significantly, a major region in the heart of Germany has long been named Saxony. The German words for Saxon, Sachs, or S-A-C-H-S-E, I don't know how to pronounce it, prominently preserve the word or the root word of Isaac, a name which was also preserved among the Scythian Saki. The Saxons who migrated to the British Isles were principally the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, but other Saxons remained on the continent and gave their name to Saxony in Germany. Since a major region of Germany was named after Isaac, it indicates that Israelites are present within Germany. The modern nation of Germany best fulfills the prophetic language of Genesis 49:19 concerning the tribe of Gad. It is the nation that led the Protestant Reformation, invented the printing press, and Gutenberg Bibles, and it excels in such peacetime pursuits as literature, music, and industry. Germany has also fulfilled the prophecy of Moses in Deuteronomy 33, verse 20, that it will constitute a large nation which can exhibit a warlike, predatory nature at times. World War II saw Germany overcome by a troop, as Genesis 49:19 prophesied for Gad in the latter days. However, West Germany emerged from World War II to overcome many of its wartime enemies in peacetime context. This is seen in such ways as industrial power, international trade, and economic and financial leadership. However, for most of the post-World War II period, East Germany languished under the impoverishing oppression of Russian communism. Even though Germany is now reunited, it will take considerable time to bring the former East Germany up to the prosperous standards of the former West Germany. Due to the Iron Curtain across Europe after World War II, West Germany shared in the birthright blessings pronounced on the tribes of Israel. But for decades, East Germany did not share them. And from a biblical point of view, this supports a conclusion that the Israelite tribe of Gad is dominant in the West part of Germany, but that non-Israelite peoples dominate the eastern portions of Germany. So number 10, we'll put in Gad, which equals Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, or at least a portion of Switzerland. Now we come to the tribe of Judah. Judah, in the time, ancient times, in the time of Moses, was the largest tribe in Israel. It had 600,000 men. Let me give us let's take our mid-program break, and let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed to the website also. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Remember to order yours. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our webpage, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, this week we are looking at a book called Israel's Tribes Today. This is a review of Stephen M. Collins' fifth book in a series on the history of Israel. Not just ancient history or biblical history, but the history of Israel from the time of Jacob around 1800 BC to last night, today, in modern times. This last book now identifies the modern nations that these tribes have settled into. As we just covered, the tribe of Gad, located in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, Dan, located in Denmark and Ireland, Benjamin, located in Norway, Naphtali in Sweden, Issachar in Finland, Asher in South Africa, Zebulun in Holland, Reuben in France, Manasseh in the United States, and Ephraim in Great Britain. We now come to number 11, which is Judah. I mentioned before the break, Judah was the largest nation in ancient times, in ancient Israel. They had 600,000 men. They took a census, I believe it's about Numbers chapter 2 or 3, and it has the populations that came out of the Egyptian captivity, measured in the number of men that were in each one of the tribes. 600,000 were in Judah. Now, there are many Jews around the world. I'm going to give you the story here from Collins' book, but primarily we see Israel today as being the homeland of the Jews. Hang on a second. The tribe of Judah, the scepter, tribe, young nation, the scepter belongs to Judah. And this is the most well-known Israelite tribe. And many readers can easily recognize this tribe in the modern world, as the Jews have long been identified as the descendants of the Israelite tribe of Judah. Well, the tribe of Judah came to be known as Jews, which is a shortened form of the word Judah, J-U-D-A-H, pronounced Judah, J-E-W-D-U-H. And while Judah was originally one of the largest tribes of Israel, it is now one of the smaller Israelite tribes in the modern world. And since the Jews were a stateless people until 1948, and given the depopulation of the Jews during World War II's Holocaust and earlier pogroms throughout history, the Jews have had little opportunity for population growth. The fact that the Jews were a stateless people for millennia supports their identification as the tribe of Judah, as we shall soon see. When the United Kingdom of Israel under David and Solomon split into two nations, the terms Judah or House of Judah referred to the southern nation with its capital at Jerusalem. The northern kingdom of Israel, inhabited by the northern ten tribes, had its capital at Samaria. Today we call Samaria Syria. The account of this division is found in 1 Kings 11 and 1 Kings 12. The kingdoms of Judah and Israel fought many wars with each other. In 2 Kings 16, verses 5 and 6, Israel made war against the Jews. And while this sounds incongruous to modern readers who are only familiar with a Jewish state named Israel, people in those ancient times would have seen nothing odd in a war between the Israelites and the Jews, as they were two different people in two separate kingdoms with two separate dynasties of kings. Now, after the death of Solomon, the Bible's use of the terms House of Israel or Israel consistently applies to the ten tribes of Israel, and the terms House of Judah or Judah consistently describes the Jews in a separate kingdom, in a separate geographical location. Judah went into captivity about 587 BC. However, a contingent of Jews was allowed by a later Persian king to return to Judea and reestablish a small Jewish enclave centered on Jerusalem. We read in Ezra 1, verses 5, and it makes it clear that only persons from the tribes of Judah, Levi, and Benjamin, the tribes of the former kingdom of Judah, were among the returnees to Jerusalem. Although Ezra wrote that only people from the tribes of the house of Judah had returned to Judea, he occasionally uses the term children of Israel when referring to them. This is accurate in a racial sense because children of Israel is synonymous with children of Jacob, and all Israelite tribes descended from Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, are in fact Israelites. I mentioned this earlier, that all Californians are Americans, but not all Americans are Californians. All Jews are Israelites, but not all Israelites are Jews. This demonstrates that the application of the term Israel can be confusing, and the context of its usage must determine the intended meaning. The ten tribes of Israel did not return to their ancient homeland, although a portion of them, the Scythians, temporarily reoccupied it during the reign of King Josiah of Judah, as documented in the second book in this series. Josephus records that the ten tribes were still living in Asia during the first century AD. Indeed, many Jews also remained in Asia with the ten tribes of Israel, as only a small contingent of Judah returned to resettle Jerusalem under the Persians. The Asian Jews later flourished in the Parthian Empire, renamed free of Roman domination. Now, when Parthia fell, many Asian Jews migrated along with the Parthians into new European homelands. Hence, the descendants of Judah are not all found within the world's Jewish population. Those Jews who migrated into Europe from Asia are often referred to as the Ashkenazi Jews. The Encyclopedia Britannica notes that the Persians called the Arsid rulers of Parthia the Ashkenians, after Ashak, a Persian term for the Parthian Arsacids. Now note the obvious similarity between the Ashkenazi Jews and the Ashkenians of Parthia. Therefore, Ashkenazi Jews actually proclaim in their name an origin in ancient Parthia. Since most of the tribe of Judah stayed in Asia, the Ashkenazi Jews are the descendants of the tribe of Judah that lived in the Parthian Empire. The Ashkenian Jews from Parthia eventually migrated into the European nations, emulating the migrations of many of the other tribes of Israel. The Ashkenazi Jews generally became the European Jews, while the Sephardic Jews generally constituted the Spanish and Mediterranean Jews. The Jews who resettled Judea under Ezra and Nehemiah were the ancestors of the Jews living in Judea at the time of Christ and his crucifixion. The Romans eventually expelled the Jews from Jerusalem altogether after the failed Bar Kochba rebellion in the 2nd century AD. After that expulsion, the Jews of Judea were a scattered people migrating to many other nations. The worldwide Jews remained in a diaspora without a nation in their old homeland of Judea until the founding of the modern state of Israel in 1948. Now, God promised that the tribe of Judah would produce a permanent dynasty of rulers or kings in Genesis 49:10 with these words. He said, "The scepter, which is a symbol of royal authority, shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come." Now, the word Shiloh means Messiah, so the above prophecy could be stated until the Messiah returns. Genesis 49 is a latter-day prophecy about the tribes of Israel, so it indicates that there must still be a dynasty of Judah reigning on earth today. The Israeli nation has no king. So Judah's dynasty cannot be ruling over the Jewish state. It has to be ruling somewhere else. Now, Jeremiah prophesied that King David's dynasty would be a perpetual dynasty in Jeremiah 33, verse 17, indicating that Judah's dynasty will be a continuously present dynasty on the earth until the Messiah returns. The Messianic kingdom has not arrived yet, so David's dynasty must still be reigning on the earth. Jeremiah 33, verse 7 gives us a very good clue. It prophesied that David's dynasty would perpetually rule over, not the Jews, but the house of Israel. So this means that when we look for David's royal progeny today among the nations of the modern 10 tribes of Israel, not the Jews. Now for a brief historical review. The Davidic dynasty was continued in Asia by the kings of Iberia in the Caucasus Mountain region, and the Saka kings of West India, and the Arsacid kings of Parthia, as earlier books in this series clearly documented. When the Parthians fled toward Europe, Arsacid princes renamed the in Armenia and continued to rule it for almost two more centuries. When the Parthian and Scythian refugees adopted names such as Goths, Germans, and Saxons on their migrations into Europe, their royalty were still descended from Parthians and Parthia's Arsacids, as discussed earlier in this book. These transplanted Arsacid princes furnished the genetic pool for many of the kings of the early European tribes as they migrated into Europe. At least some of the royal houses of Europe descended from hereditary Parthian princes who led tribes of Goths, Germans, and Saxons into Europe. Some of these dynasties still exist in the royalty of modern Europe, even though their roles are now chiefly ceremonial. Since the royal houses of Europe often intermarried, David's royal blood was scattered widely throughout Europe's ruling dynasties. Genealogies confirming that the royalty of Great Britain are descended from King David in an unbroken line are found in some books. One such genealogy is cited in E. Raymond Capp's book, Jacob's Pillar. I should also mention here that there is a society called the British Israel Society. They used to be located at number 1 Buckingham Gate in London, and they keep the genealogy of all of the royal families of Europe. And Queen Elizabeth's genealogy traces back to Adam and Eve. And if you can trace your genealogy back to any of the royal families of Europe, you too can trace your genealogy all the way back to Adam and Eve. Now, E. Raymond Capp's genealogy does not trace the British royal house ancestry through the Parthian royal house, but rather through the dynasties of Ireland and Scotland, whose members descended from a daughter of the last king of Judah. This princess was brought to Ireland by the prophet Jeremiah, along with important artifacts from the ancient kingdom of Judah, and this was discussed in the previous chapter of this book, as well as in the second book in this series. Intermarriage between the royalty of the British Isles and the other royal families on the European continent actually reunited the separate branches of David's royal descendants. These historical facts mean that the royal residents of Buckingham Palace today are descended from King David and the royal house of the ancient kingdom of Judah. Other European royalty are as well. Now, the term divine right of kings may have originated in a long-forgotten awareness that many European rulers were descended from King David. David's descendants really do possess a divine right to rule, based on God's promises to King David. The Encyclopedia Britannica makes this statement about the divine right of kings. The principle that the kingship is descendable in one sacred family is not only still that of the British Constitution, as that of the monarchical states, but is practically that of the kingship from the beginning. And this is, however, quite a different thing from asserting not only that legitimate monarchs derive their authority from God alone, but that this authority is by divine ordinance, hereditary, in a certain order of succession. Unquote. And the Britannica also states the following regarding the selection of kings in early European history. Quote, the power of popular election remained even though popular choice, as by custom or religious sentiment, confined within the limits of a single family, the custom of primogeniture, see if I can pronounce that now, P-R-I-M-O, primogeniture, grew up to avoid ruinous contests. Early European kings were once elected from the members of a given royal family. This practice was directly copied from the monarchical selection practice of the Parthian Empire. Parthian kings were elected by the Magi, the nobility from the male members of the King David's royal seed. They're called the Arsacids, and since early European kings were selected by way of the Parthian method, it follows that the kings were still being selected from the hereditary descendants of Parthia's royalty, who had accompanied their subjects' migrations into Europe. The custom of primogeniture refers to the automatic coronation of the previous king's eldest son as the next king. This practice eliminated the murderous intrigues among competing members of royal houses for the throne, a problem which had also been the bane of the Parthian royal house. Now we will consider an aspect of Jewish history that is sometimes controversial, and this is the history or the story of the Khazar kingdom of Asia, whose later monarchs adopted Judaism. Some people assume that the Khazars were non-Israelites who en masse accepted Judaism and became the forebears of all of the Ashkenazi Jews of Europe. This dogma disenfranchises the Ashkenazi Jews as legitimate Jews from the tribe of Judah. This is historically inaccurate. It assumes A, that all Khazars were Gentiles, and B, all Khazars accepted Judaism, and C, no members of the house of Judah were already living among the Khazars. All three of these assumptions are incorrect. It has been established that numerous Jews lived in the Parthian Empire, and many of these Jews likely accompanied the migrating Parthians into Europe through the Caucasus Mountains and into territory north of the Black Sea. Other Jewish migrations to that region occurred in other centuries, as we shall soon document. This region, through which hordes of Israelites and Jews passed on their way to Europe, was the homeland of the Khazars. How could the Khazars all be Gentiles when their homeland had been the main expressway for the tribes of Israel as they left Parthia and Scythia? The Khazar region also included the region of the former kingdom of Iberia, which had borne a Hebrew name since its founding, soon after the fall of the Israelite capital of Samaria. Iberia had also been ruled by kings with the root word Pharez in their names, confirming their descent from King David of Israel. Surely, there were still many Israelites left in this region when the Khazars came to power there in later centuries. And there is considerable evidence that the Khazars were a mixture of many races and ethnic groups living in one region. The Encyclopedia Britannica records that the Khazars were first noticed in Armenia in 198 AD. This was 28 years before Parthia fell, and when Parthia collapsed, millions of Semitic people from Parthia poured through the region later to be called Khazaria, like a tidal wave on their way to Europe. Well, during the centuries of the great migrations of the Parthian and Scythian refugees through the Trans-Caucasian region, the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel were dominant in the region which later became Khazaria. The Khazar rulers did not adopt Judaism until the year 740 AD or even later. So let us consider how many waves of Jewish refugees entered Khazaria before that event occurred. Large numbers of Jewish refugees had settled in what became Khazaria long before the Khazars were even a recognizable people. It is recorded in the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia that Vikusti's History of Georgia, the oldest history extant, informs us that permission was granted to a Jewish legation which had appealed to the Prince of Meshet after the destruction of the first temple of Jerusalem in 586 BC to settle on the outskirts of Meshet. Jews from the tribe of Judah began settling in the Transcaucasus from the time that Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians. The same source records many more waves of Jewish migration in this region. Another influx of Jewish refugees into various Transcaucasian regions took place after the destruction of the Second Temple at Jerusalem in 70 AD, and the height of the influx during the first centuries of Christianity is confirmed by the chronicler Faustus of Byzantium, 4th century AD, who reports that the Persians, under King Sapor II in 360 AD, invaded Armenia and took with them to South Persia more than 75,000 Jewish captives, the progeny of those who had previously come to the Transcaucasus from Palestine. Now, the Jews had seen the Caucasus region as a hospitable refuge for centuries, and they went there in large numbers. Why shouldn't they? From 700 BC until at least the 5th century AD, it was inhabited by many descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel under names such as Scythians, Iberians, the Saki, and Goths. Many of the Israelite kings were Jewish descendants of King David's dynasty. The Persian king Sapor II was from the Persian Sassanian kingdom that had driven the Parthians out of Asia. There had to be an immense number of Jews in the Transcaucasus region for him to take over 75,000 Jews captive in a single raid into the area. As we read in the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, which continues, subsequently, they, the Transcaucasian Jews, were joined by other Jews from more westerly regions. Well, we're about out of time, so I'm going to chop it off right there. We're talking about the tribe of Judah, one of the major tribes, just like the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh, Great Britain and the United States. So he has developed quite a little story here on the Jews. We'll break it off right there. Let me remind you that this is Israel's Tribes Today by Stephen M. Collins. You can get a copy of the book from the publisher, Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Or you can get on the web and you'll see Bible Blessings. That's all one word, just BibleBlessings.net. Now, I sent the author, the fellow Stephen Collins, a $100 bill. Let me give you his name and number. It's Stephen Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And he'll send you all five books. That's what he did for me. He sent me all five of the books in the series. And you'll notice that as we're reading along, he has references to other books in the series. If you're a real student of history, you'll want all five of these books. I'm telling you, they're dynamite. That's 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. That's Stephen Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Be sure to tell him to autograph the books. $100 bill. All right, I'm about out of time. We got one more program left in the series, and we'll finish up with Judah and these two other tribes, Simeon and Levi, next time on the Law Hour. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, with the conclusion. So thanks for listening, and until then, good night, friends.